You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And top of the Monday to you. I got to stop talking like I'm Irish. I'm not. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, the American way. I don't know. Maybe there's some Irish in there. Who knows? Tom Hartman here with you. What a day. What a weekend. What a incredible fireworks for the here in Washington D.C. for the Cherry Blossom Festival this weekend. It was just extraordinary. And the weird thing is the cherry blossoms happened 2 weeks ago. Now, you know, normally you'd think this was like really bad planning, but in fact, 100 years ago, when the Japanese gave us the cherry blossoms, they bloomed this last weekend. And it's been that way for most of that 100 years, until the last 6 or 8 or 10 years. And now it's moving back, moving back. We're the only developed country in the world that is still debating global warming. It's like everybody else is actually doing something about it. It's amazing. And speaking about doing something about it, the big corporations and the plutocrats, the Koch brothers and the other billionaires in America, working very hard to promote their own particular interests. The oil companies, for example, Koch brothers oil company, or you know, ExxonMobil, or I mean, pick one, BP. They want to make sure that they own their share of politicians. Now, for centuries, the way that plutocrats and oligarchs have paid off those politicians is, well, actually, they've found a whole bunch of different ways to do it. They gave them campaign contributions. They took them on golf trips to Scotland. Remember Tom DeLay? Drop them in a hot tub with champagne and hookers. Remember Duke Cunningham? That got a little expensive. And you couldn't buy every politician that way, and you certainly couldn't buy uncorruptible politicians that way, but or marginally uncorruptible politicians. It's a lot harder to buy everybody with a lot of, you know, it just takes a lot of cash and a lot of hookers. With Citizens United, that opened up two doors. Now, the one that I'm going to tell you about first, everybody knows about, but the second one, I don't think anybody really knows about, and it just became real over the weekend. And this is an astounding story. With Citizens United, first of all, they can now also buy millions of dollars worth of advertising to promote candidates, thus putting them, those candidates, into the debt of the oligarchs for the rest of their political careers. I mean, that's kind of cool, I guess, if you're an oligarch. You can spend, you know, it used to be you could only spend $2,500 on a candidate. Or if you could find 100 friends, you could raise $25,000, $250,000. But, you know, you had to bundle and all. Yeah, it took a lot of work. Now you can just write a check for $1 million. Create a PAC, run ads to help your favorite politician, get him elected or her. And then, you know, whenever you call, they take your call. But now there's this new twist, because buying politicians costs money. Now, historically, it's been good money. I mean, there's a return on that investment. Big oil, for example, gets a 5,800% return on its investment in buying politicians. You know, a normal business return in good times, 10 to 40%, you get business returns much higher than that, and competition will start coming into the marketplace. So, you know, 10%, 20%, 30% return on investment, pretty damn good. Profit margins, I mean, you know, the health insurance industry operates profit margins, 10, 12%, 8%. These are normal. But a 4,800% interest, you know, return on investment, that's what you can get if you buy politicians. It's the best business investment you can make in America. And it's why industries have cartelized their politician buying efforts. They run them through trade associations like the NRA or business groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So buying politicians has become pretty much an industry into itself. There's a whole other possibility that Citizens United opened up that is just now getting to be used. What if you could get all 535 members of the House and Senate to do your bidding at the federal level, and tens of thousands of people at the state and local level, without buying any of them? What if you didn't even need to spend any money at all on all but, say, a few, maybe just, you know, 30, 40, 50 of them? How do you pull that off? How do you make 435 members of Congress, 535 members of Congress do what you want by only spending money on 30, 40, 50 of them? You use a stick instead of a carrot. Up until now, it's been all carrots. It's been by politicians. Here, have some champagne, have some hookers, have a cruise, have a golf trip. Let's go to the Saipan. The new corporate and oligarch plan is to control the American political process, not by buying politicians, not by being nice to them, not by buying them golf trips or hookers or campaign contributions, but by threatening to destroy them. Think about that for a minute. And then you go out as an oligarch, as an industry, you actually go out and destroy a few politicians. This is how slaves were kept in line 200 years ago in this country. Whip or murder a few for getting out of line, and the rest would behave. Until slavery was outlawed, it worked quite well to keep slaves doing the master's work. And now American oligarchs and corporations have decided to bring in a political slave breaker. The American Banker, this is a magazine online website, it's kind of the banking industry publication, it reports on this new politician breaker. It's a political action committee, a super PAC, actually. And instead of giving gifts to politicians, they'll just totally break a few, which will scare the rest into submission without costing the banksters a penny. The super PAC is called Friends of Traditional Banking. As Howard Hedley, the president and CEO of the Utah Bankers Association, said in an article in the American Banker, you can read it online right now. It'll be in our daily, the links to it all will be in our daily stack in our newsletter. In our newsletter. He said it comes back to the old philosophy of walking softly and carrying a big stick. Remember I said carrots or sticks? Stick. In the tradition of slave breakers, Roger Beveridge, the president and CEO of the Oklahoma Bankers Association, said for the American Banker article, quote, Congress isn't afraid of bankers. They don't think we'll do anything to kick them out of office. We are trying to change that perception. End quote. Matt Packard, the Super PAC's chairman, who's also the president and CEO of the $670 million asset Central Bank of Provo, Utah, calls the politician breaking efforts surgical, his word. He told the American Banker this would be much more effective than traditional campaign contributions that bankers used to give. He said, someone says I'm going to give your opponent $5,000 or $10,000, you might say, yeah, okay. But if you say the bankers are going to put in $100,000 or $500,000 or $1 million into your opponent's campaign, that starts to draw some attention. End of quote. Politician breaking is the new political sport in America. Thanks to the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, Karl Rove has already amassed millions and says he's going to use it to destroy progressive politicians nationwide, as well as against President Obama. Same with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and others. Actually, the destroy is not a verbatim quote from Karl Rove, but, you know, we know where he's at. Hopefully, this will be the moment when the banksters and other corporate interest groups and oligarchs have gone too far, like the slave rebellions against the slave breakers that eventually helped bring about abolition. Hopefully this new effort by oligarchs to break politicians of both parties will unite those politicians of both parties against Citizens United. This could be the straw that broke the camel's back. This could be the one too many. This could be the thing that causes politicians in both parties to say, yeah, it was nice when we were taking their money, but now that they're turning it on us as a weapon, we're going to go to movetoamend.org and sign up for that constitutional amendment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's really quite remarkable. By the way, time-traveling Ronald Reagan agrees with Barack Obama again.
Hope, struggle, and change. Hope, struggle, and change. There's trouble and danger on the road to justice. Gonna keep on hoping. Gonna keep my eyes open.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. The White House, President Obama, was going to sign an executive order this week that said that if you are a federal contractor, in other words, if you get a check from the federal government for work that you do, you know, like you make jets or you make tanks or you make bombs or you build roads, you know, whatever you do, if you're a federal contractor, you have to disclose your lobbying efforts. What politicians are you giving money to? Now, there's a very, very simple reason for this. And the very simple reason was that if, well, here's the cycle, okay? Contractor gets, say, $1 million in a contract. Out of that $1 million, say they make, you know, $300,000 in profit. Let's say they get $100 million. Out of that $100 million in that, for that contract, they make $3 million, $30 million. Well, probably an average is around 10%. They say they make 10% profit. Okay. Out of that $10 million profit, they take $1 million and they buy a bunch of politicians so that they can get another $100 million contract. So this is how the cycle has worked. Is that federal contractors buy politicians, they lobby them, and then those politicians make sure that the federal contractors get more money. And this is, I mean, you saw this on display hugely during the Bush administration, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. That was massively, I mean, the vast majority of the contracts that were let out, and these, keep in mind, these were multi-hundred-billion-dollar operations, ultimately going to be, you know, a couple of trillion dollars spent on these two wars. Most of them were no-bid contracts. Why were they no-bid contracts? Because the contractors didn't want to have to bid against each other, compete against each other. The politicians set it up so that whoever was most well-connected got the contract. It's really simple. So to try and break that cycle, to try and stop that, the Obama administration was going to sign an executive order saying that if you're a federal contractor, you have to disclose your lobbying efforts. The Republicans and the conservatives and the right-wing media has been so hysterical about this. They've turned it into such a political issue that President Obama has backed off and said, we'll wait until after the election. This is amazing. Now, meanwhile, in the Senate and in the House, the Democrat, I don't want to say the Democratic Party, but, you know, Democratic members of the House and Senate have introduced legislation to do the exact same thing in the House and the Senate. That would say if you get federal dollars, it doesn't even say you can't lobby. You can't buy members of Congress to get more. It simply says if you get federal dollars, you have to disclose who you're giving it to. Who are you giving those federal dollars to who's a politician, an elected official? And surprise, surprise, the House of Representatives is controlled by John Boehner, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, the Republicans. They won't allow this to come to the floor for a vote. In the Senate, the Democrats have enough votes to bring it to the floor, but the Republicans are filibustering it. They won't allow debate to end. How can anybody look at this kind of stuff and not just say, this is mind-boggling. We have one of the most corrupt political parties in American history. I mean, these guys make the Whigs look good. They make the High Federalists look good in the 1820s when their party was disintegrating. They make Richard Nixon look good, to use a more contemporary example. I mean, you look back at Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon at least wanted a national health care system. He proposed one. Everybody had to buy into private health insurance. There was a public option. There was, you know, there was a mandate. There were caps on the amount of public money that could go for private middlemen. The Nixon program came to be known as the Romney program. The Romney program came to be known as the Obama program. We look back at Richard Nixon now, and, you know, other than that little thing about spying on the Democrats by breaking into the Watergate, and other than that little thing about taking bribes, especially like back in 1959, 1960 from the Dairymen's Association, other than those little things, other than talking to the South Vietnamese and saying to them, hey, don't negotiate with Lyndon Johnson. Let the war go on through the 1968 election so Humphrey will lose. Other than those little things, Richard Nixon actually seems like rational compared to today's Republicans. He thought Social Security should remain a strong and viable program. During Richard Nixon, you had a very, very high level of unionization in this country. Almost a quarter of all workers in this country were unionized. That was fine with him. It's just amazing when you look at you look at the math on all this stuff and you look at what's going on. Governor Scott Walker, and Rachel Maddow last Thursday, I guess it was, she broke this story, although it's apparently the Democrats in Michigan have been screaming about this for some time, that Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, had a conversation with one of my brothers over the weekend who used to be a political consultant who lives in Michigan. And he was like, oh, Snyder's out there saying, oh, he doesn't like this stuff that's going on. You know, he's trying to CYA. But the Republicans keep pushing it through, and he keeps signing the bills with immediate action, immediate effect. But the Michigan Constitution says they come into effect 90 days after the end of the congressional term. So all these laws, some 500 laws, have been passed illegally and unconstitutionally in Michigan by the Republicans. Tell me a big stink isn't coming there. How can people look at this? Scott Walker over the weekend signing all these wackadoodle laws and just before the Easter holiday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The old time-tested methods to make sure that you don't get it in the news cycle, right? I think people are starting to wake up. Do you? There's now a free app for the Tom Hartman Program at the App Store. You can listen, watch, and read our newsletter, plus the Daily Stack there.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out.
Oh, maybe not. Can Democrats ever... Can anybody ever live with a party... Well, part of the Democratic Party has been corrupted this way, too, you could say. But the Republican Party, blocking legislation that would allow require federal contractors to disclose who they're lobbying to get more federal contracts? What? President Reagan, April 15th is coming up, right? It's this weekend? Is it a Saturday? I don't have a calendar in front of me. But anyhow, it's coming up soon. Sometime around this coming weekend. And, in fact, let me pull a calendar up and take a quick look here so I can tell you. Yeah, April 15th is Sunday. So, yes, Sunday. And so, it's a great opportunity to talk about the Buffett rule. All the right-wingers are going to be out there talking about taxes.
Yeah, we pay too much taxes.
Well, if you think paying, like Mitt Romney, 15% on millions and millions of dollars in income that you make sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, if you think that is too much tax, you should really have a talk with Dwight Eisenhower. But in any case, or you should have a conversation with Ronald Reagan. Mitt Romney pays a lower tax rate than his secretary does. Presumably, I'm assuming that his secretary is paid salary and he is paid capital gains and dividends. And so he pays a maximum 15% rate and his secretary or secretaries, he or she pay presumably up to 35-36%, the maximum income tax rate for working people. Now, President Obama says that's crazy and that somebody who's a multimillionaire should be paying at least the same rate as average people. And oddly enough, so does Ronald Reagan. The good folks over at the Center for American Progress unearthed this clip from Ronald Reagan shortly after he left the White House, after he left the presidency, talking about this. Here he is.
Just a moment ago, a few moments ago, I told some people inside the building here of a letter that I just received day before yesterday. It's a letter from a man out here in the country, an executive who's earning in six figures, well above $100,000 a year. He wrote me in support of the tax plan because he said, I am legally able to take advantage of the present tax code, nothing dishonest, doing what the law prescribes, and wind up paying a smaller salary than my secretary gets. Paying a smaller tax than my secretary pays. And he wrote me the letter to tell me he'd like to come to Washington and testify before Congress as to how that's possible for him to do and why it is wrong.
That's pretty straightforward. It's hard to argue against that. Warren Buffett's secretary shouldn't pay a higher tax rate than Warren Buffett.
There you go. And maybe that's why they put Reagan up to pasture. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Mark in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Mark, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
You know, that story that you had a little earlier about the bankers and the slave smackdown and everything else going on. I mean, between that and what's going on at the various state levels and with Citizens United, et cetera, it just, I'm sorry, I get very, very discouraged. It seems to me that there is a wave of evil, literal evil, in terms of vote suppression and everything else going on in this country, which, frankly, makes me sometimes feel like I'm living in Germany in 1932.
Well, here's the good news. You've got in fact, Mark, thank you for the call. Let me just riff on this for a minute before I pick up another call. The good news is you've got down in Florida right now. Well, I guess the bad news is that Trayvon Martin, the state attorney general, has announced that they're not going to take the Trayvon Martin case to a grand jury. At the same time, you've got the Nazis. You know what Nazi is an acronym for? Nazi. National Social, National Socialism. I don't know how to say it in German. But anyway, National Socialism. And the Fox station down in Orlando referred to these guys as a civil rights group. Clip number three, Jacob.
We're in the Seminole County area currently doing patrols in the wake of the Trayvon shooting down there.
There's another civil rights group in town, the National Socialist Movement.
A lot of people in the community, in the white community down there, had been contacting us out of concern for their safety just because of racial tensions. We're a white civil rights organization, and we go into areas where we're needed and where white citizens need our help.
This is a group that says that Adolf Hitler is their Führer and their father. This is a group that says that the Constitution was written by white men and only applies to same. And they are referred to by this Fox 35 in Orlando as a civil rights group. Anyhow, they're walking around with guns in Florida. Now, that sounds like the bad news, but here's the good news about all that. Everybody in America knows who Trayvon Martin is. Most people do. That pretty much wasn't the case for a long, long time. And actually, there have been a few Trayvon Martins since Trayvon Martin that most people don't know about. But people are waking up. People are waking up to the political corruption. People are waking up to the Koch brothers. People are raising, I think that they're, well, actually, you know, here's this. This is the good news. 8,000 progressives around the country have signed up to run for public office in the 2012 election. The group that is putting this together is called the Candidate Project. And just Google Candidate Project and you can get on it. So you know, my bottom line is that, yeah, it looks really bad. And I think, as I said earlier, I think this may be the straw that breaks the camel's back. I really do. I mean, we will see, but I think so. Virginia in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Hi. I would like to basically eliminate all deductions and just have one deduction. That would be $25,000 per adult.
Why?
And that way you could, why? Because I think there, I think that people, I think it would make it fair.
Okay, so you don't think that anybody who wants to put aside money for old age should be able to do so tax-free?
I wouldn't say that, but I say the present system is not working.
Okay, and you don't think that anybody who wants to buy a home should be able to deduct the interest payments from
that? I don't. I think that is unfair because renters wouldn't get that deduction.
You know, I don't disagree with you altogether on that, Virginia. In fact, I think we have a hard time making a case that people should get $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, whatever it is, a year for having had kids now. You know, the child deduction.
But I think that
you're not talking about a single flat tax rate. You're talking about just eliminating the deductions.
I'm talking about eliminate the deductions and making the top percent 25% and making that at $200,000.
Why would you do that? If you look at the history of the United States, the times when this country was the most stable and the most prosperous, the top tax rate, it didn't kick in until you made, you know, more or less $1 million in today's dollars. But after that, you started paying between 70 and 90%. So most people didn't take that money. They kept it in their businesses. Why would you want to take it down to 25%?
Well, maybe we should have a very big tax in on anyone making more than $1 million. And maybe that should go up to 70 or 80% or even 90%. I wouldn't disagree with that, but I do think we have to have a real tax discussion in this country.
And the tax discussion is that when we used to have the tax code that we had in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, where poor working people paid basically no income taxes. And, you know, in fact, when the income tax started out, it was 1% on income after $1 million in today's money. And the same when Lincoln was in office. So if we were to, when you go back to that period of time, very poor people were not paying taxes. Basically, the rich were paying, you know, taxes on money. They weren't paying much tax on their first money. I mean, that's the whole point of a progressive income tax is, you know, your first couple $100,000, you don't pay that much on, or your first couple tens of thousands of dollars. But as you start making more and more money, as you start using the system more and more, as you're using the court system more and more, as you're using the infrastructure of the country more and more, as you're using all the stuff that this country provides that allows for businesses to happen and that allows for people to get rich, you start paying more and more for it. This is just common sense, and it actually works better. And if you look at when the country was working the best, that was when we had that kind of a tax code. And so, yeah, I agree that we need to have a conversation about taxes. But I think that the Romney talking point about 25%, that's crazy. 25% is, you know, when Bill Clinton took it from 36 to 39%, he at least was able to balance the federal budget and create a surplus that if he had kept it there, if George Bush hadn't dropped it, we'd be in a surplus right now. We would have paid down the national debt. So, you know, Virginia, thank you for the call, but be careful. I mean, it's... You know, Romney's running around with his 25% proposal, and he doesn't want to change that on capital gains, by the way. He wants to continue paying 14%. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The thing that's most amazing to me is that people who I believe are of good nature and good intention, like Virginia, get snookered by this stuff. So we keep away. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Dave in Taos, Michigan?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Hey, all the trees are the right height here today.
Oh, good. That's reassuring.
And corporations don't pay taxes here. They, for the last 20 years, when a business wants to move into community, they bid it up between communities and...
Right.
They go to where they don't have to pay taxes.
Yeah, this is something that should be against the law. Bernie Sanders proposed that any state that allows this lose their federal highway funds.
Well, corporations, if you know, churches don't pay taxes. We have separation, church and state.
Yeah.
If corporations don't pay taxes, should we have separation between corporation and state?
I think we should, and the Supreme Court has done its best to blow that up. But, no, good point, Dave, and thanks for making the call. Rich in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The Taurus, the wealth-attracting sign. excuse me. This is kind of like Paul and Paula Rivera reincarnated 2012 here, Tom. If you've been watching Rachel Maddow Friday, MSNBC, 9 Eastern time tonight, you know, she did a thing on Michigan and the dictatorship.
I saw it on the internet. I didn't see it on TV, but I watched her clip. And it was great.
Yeah, I never heard anybody call it her call anything a dictatorship before. Tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time, MSNBC, she's going to do a doable thing on how to deal with this Michigan dictatorship.
Okay, great. Rich, thanks a lot for the commercial. Nate in Annapolis. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm fine. It says here that you want to argue with me.
No, not necessarily want to argue with you. You talk about you disagree with the fact that Warren Buffett's secretary pays more in taxes than he does.
Right.
As
a percentage of your income.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I disagree that, you know, capital gains is lower than the income tax. My question for you is, why should the income tax be higher? In other words, what's wrong with a 15% rate for everybody? What's wrong with...
Well, first of all, it doesn't generate enough revenue to fund the government. Secondly,
okay, so why is that a bad thing? Why can't we cut back?
Because our government right now is about 20% of our GDP, and it is dying. It is hurting us. We don't, you know, our GIs are not getting decent services when they come back from the military. We have a $2 trillion deficit. Ever since Reagan, we haven't fixed a bridge, basically. We've got bridges that are falling apart. We've got water systems that are falling apart. We've got sewage systems that are falling apart. And this is the 19th century infrastructure. And we got infrastructure that was built in the 1800s that needs to be repaired and replaced. And the Republicans are obstructing that. Nobody's even talking about building 21st century infrastructure. Germany just devoted 8% of their GDP. Keep in mind, our entire government is 20% of GDP. Germany just devoted 8% of their GDP to build a national smart grid so that everybody can have solar panels on their house and the smart grid can handle all the electricity flying around in all the 16 different ways to Sunday. And they can do away entirely with nuclear power and entirely with oil-fired power plants.
Let me stop you right there, Tom. Wait a second. Why can Germany afford that? Because they've relied on us and the rest of the Western world since the end of World War II for national defense.
Not true. Germany has a very substantial army. They have a meaningful part of their GDP.
No, I disagree. If you've seen the state of their military,
our bases in Germany are not to defend Germany. Our bases in Germany are to defend us. They were there against Russia as part of the Cold War. Number one.
Sure.
Number two, the Germans pay income taxes around, you know, it depends on your income, of course, but, you know, anywhere from 30% to 60%. Rich people in Germany pay well over 50% in income taxes, and they do so gladly. This clip is apocryphal. It's been all over the internet. This was 6 months ago. I think it was on Bloomberg. This German businessman was being interviewed by the guy out of Singapore who does the evening news there, and he says, you know, how can you stand paying so much in income taxes? And the guy, you know, after the third time he asked, the guy kept saying, oh, it's not a problem. And third time he asked, the guy says, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country. Is that what you want?
You know, No, I don't. But
Think that your country should, as Germany does, give everybody basically a free education all the way through college? That if you want to be a doctor, it shouldn't be only possible to you if you came from a family like Mitt Romney's?
No, I think you should be able to stand on your own two feet and, you know.
So if you are not a member of the Lucky Sperm Club and you're born to poor parents, screw you if you want to go to college.
Well, no, I disagree because I paid for college on my own. Thank you very much.
How?
So, I mean, how?
How?
I worked through college.
Worked doing what? What can you possibly do that could pay for medical school?
There's plenty of things you can do for medical school. You can serve in the military, and they'll pay for your medical school. You can work your way through. And
so you can become slave labor.
I'm sorry?
You can become slave labor, or you can go in debt. What I'm saying is that as a country, we should be investing in our young people, in our future, in our intellectual infrastructure. We're the only developed country in the world that doesn't do that. As a country, we should be saying healthcare is a right. We were founded on the principle of the right to life. How can you have life if you are sick and you can't get treatment?
Okay, well then, how can you be a supporter of women's choice?
How can you have life if your body is falling apart and you cannot get treatment? How can you, you haven't answered my question. How can you have life if you are sick and can't get treatment? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You're entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We can debate all day long when life begins, but I'm talking about people who are walking around talking. How can you have life if you don't have national health care? If you don't have the right to life? If you don't have the right to health care? How can you have it?
Okay. Okay. Well, answer me this then. How is this?
I haven't heard an answer to my question yet.
Okay.
Nate?
Well, I'm going to answer you with another question.
No, you can answer me with an answer. Tell me, you know, how can we be a developed nation and not in the 21st century and not even have a discussion about 21st century infrastructure? Instead, we're having a debate about a 19th century oil pipeline running across the middle of our country so that the oil refineries owned by the British and the Dutch can export gasoline to England, South America, Mexico, and China. This is crazy. I don't understand how Republicans can be and conservatives like you, Nate, can be supporting this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what are we going to do about energy as we move forward? Only a little less than 1% of our electricity in this country comes from oil. A fair amount comes from coal and nuclear. Solar and wind are growing. We have five states now where more than 20% of the power in those states, including Texas, comes from wind and solar. But there are still those folks out there pitching nukes. Dr. Robert Zubrin is one, contributing editor to the New Atlantis. TheNewAtlantis.com, founder and president of the Mars Society, the author of his latest book, Merchants of Despair, Radical Environmentalists, Criminal Pseudoscientists, and the Fatal Cult of Anti-Humanism. Robert Zubrin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. I don't understand how anybody who claims to be a conservative can support nuclear power when nuclear power plants only exist by virtue of government welfare.
I don't claim to be conservative. I'm politically independent.
Okay. I don't understand how anybody who claims to be rational can support nuclear power when nuclear power plants only exist by virtue of government welfare.
Well, I disagree. You know, we developed hydroelectric plants in this country under the Roosevelt administration, and progressive people all supported it. Woody Guthrie, roll on, Columbia, your power is turning our darkness to dawn.
I don't recall, you know, toxic waste coming out of the Bonneville Dam. I used to live near there.
After hydroelectric power, nuclear power is the cleanest power we've got.
Really?
Sure.
All those people who live near the mines who are exposed to the tailings, all that water that's contaminated by the tailings, uranium tailings, all of that nuclear waste, that's just peachy keen stuff. We should, what, put it in our food?
I'm really surprised to hear you say all this, given the Obama administration has just pretty much banned new coal-fired power plants in this country. We've got to have power.
I'm not a fan of coal power plants either. Germany is doing really well with solar. Denmark's doing really well with wind. We're doing well. Texas is 20% of their power is coming from wind in Texas right now.
Okay. Well, let me just say this, okay? I believe that people that are, that we have to place human welfare at the center of our value system. And that means particularly the welfare of the poor.
So why would we create waste byproducts that are deadly for a million years?
No American has ever died of nuclear waste. But let me finish this.
Oh, come on.
Okay, expensive energy is a regressive tax. It's a tax on Americans, and it's extremely regressive tax on the world's poor. High oil prices is a regressive tax.
So let's give people solar panels for their homes.
Solar panels are among the most expensive forms of energy that
they're
there is.
Not. Germany, the price of solar panels has dropped in half twice in the last 10 years. Germany now has, they started out to replicate one nuclear power plant, 1 gigawatt of electricity, and they now have 10. They had to stop their program, you know, that was, it wasn't even a subsidy. It didn't cost the government a penny. But they had to stop this program of basically banks backstopping bank loans to homeowners to put solar panels on their roofs, and because there's too much. They've got they've committed 8% of their GDP to upgrade their grid system because they got all this electricity coming into it, and it's an old-fashioned grid. It can't handle it. Why don't we do something smart like that rather than a centralized power plant like a nuclear power plant? It makes no sense.
Well, the basic question is, are we going to have policies in this country that create artificial shortages so that people can, say there isn't enough to go around, so human aspirations need to be constrained?
How can you have an artificial shortage if you've got solar collectors on your roof?
That create abundance. And that's the essence of the issue here. That's the essence of the issue with nuclear power, with the genetically modified crops. It's the essence of the issue with all these new technologies. It used to be the progressives in this country supported technological progress, and now they've been sold a bill of goods to want to support policies of technological reaction.
Let me just
that,
get this right.
Maybe
I'm misunderstanding you.
Harm the world's poor.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding you. We're talking to Dr. Robert Zubrin. Maybe I'm misunderstanding you. In India, where they are going into poor villages and they're putting solar panels on the roofs of huts that have never had electricity so that people can use cell phones and access the internet and have little cook stoves and lights at night. And it's basically free. I mean, once they've got the solar panel, they've got free electricity for the 50-year lifespan of the solar panel. And in Germany, people do that on their homes. You've got, 15-20% of the homes in Germany now are producing as much electricity as they consume. And many are producing a significant surplus. You're saying that that kind of local, independent energy self-sufficiency is a bad thing, and having a for-profit corporation run a nuclear power plant that is subsidized by the federal government, that Wall Street, Goldman Sachs will not do an IPO for a nuclear power plant, won't do it, has to be subsidized by the federal government, is a good thing. Do I have this right?
No.
Okay, what am I missing?
You're missing is that I have no objection to people putting solar powers on their roofs.
If we're going to do an $11 billion subsidy to the nuclear power industry, why not do the same for solar panels then?
No, the nuclear power has been so hamstrung by overregulation that has vastly increased its cost.
Oh, we should deregulate them. That worked really well with the banks.
Well, no,
when they blew up, Nobody got radioactive. I mean, you want it like Fukushima?
Wait.
TEPCO was not reporting to the government. They were ignoring the regulations. That's what we should do with our nuclear industry?
People in Fukushima were killed by tidal waves and falling buildings. Not one person has been killed by a nuclear power plant.
Nonsense.
No, it's not nonsense. It's a fact.
People have died all over this world from nuclear power plants, and know it. There's no such thing as a safe dose of radiation. Pretty much everybody can now, you can find radioactive cesium in every, it's all over the United States from Fukushima, if nothing else.
Wayne died from Fukushima?
John Wayne died from being downwind of he and everybody else who was on that movie that he was making, they all died because a couple hundred miles upwind, they did an above ground nuclear test. And you don't have nuclear bombs if you don't have a nuclear power industry.
No, that's not true. We had thousands of nuclear bombs before we had our first commercial.
You're right, of the United States, but not of any other country in the world. Every other country in the world has used a domestic nuclear power industry to generate the concentrated uranium for their bombs.
That's actually untrue. No, that's factually untrue. You can't use the nuclear power, the waste from nuclear power plants does not make good bomb-grade material, and I know something about this.
Well, the processing, the process of amplifying, of centrifuging out, and I'm missing the word for it, but increasing the potency of the uranium, of raising, what is it, U-235 and decreasing U-233 or 234, that process is the same process. You take it up to 3% for a nuclear power plant. You take it up to 90% for a bomb. It's the same process. So you build that stuff for your nuclear power industry, and then you use it for your bomb industry.
You can make enrichment without a bomb. Okay, that's a fact of the matter. Okay, yes, you can. Enrichment technology can be used to make fuel for reactors or for
India
bombs.
Made the bomb.
I actually recommend taking bomb
program.
Grade material and degrading it to reactor grade material. And
Pakistan made the bomb out of their program. But you still haven't answered my question. Why would any rational person support an industry that could not exist if it wasn't for government welfare?
Because after hydroelectric power, it's the cleanest source of large-scale power we've got.
Solar power is not
and,
clean.
Well, actually, the chemical processes involved in making solar power plants are not completely clean, no. But also, they're
and the chemical processes involved in purifying uranium are.
Yeah, but listen, let me ask something, okay? Because I'm actually a little surprised that you focused on nuclear power, because the main thrust of the book is this whole issue of whether we go with a pro-growth world outlook or a zero-growth world outlook. And I know that you've been an advocate of population control in the past, and
I have not.
You haven't? Because I thought I saw an interview.
I'm an advocate of empowering women, which causes them to have family sizes that they want, which typically are about, you know, more or less around two. So stabilizing.
Then you agree with me that these programs that force sterilization on women in the third world are completely wrong.
They don't work.
Well,
they don't work.
They're also
wrong. Yeah, they're morally wrong, and they don't work. But that's not the point.
The book has a major expose of that.
Okay.
Dr.
Robert Zubin, we're out of time, sir. The New Atlantic is Atlantis.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Chris, listening on AM 950 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Minnesota's progressive voice. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Not much. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
The person earlier talking about nuclear energy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 20 years old. I'm in college. It's pretty much, I'm going to be part of the people who's going to be paying back the debt. But at the same time, we're going to also be trying to fix this planet because people are just so set on making money to the point where they disregard what, you know, my generation is going to have to fix with oil and
You guys get to decommission the nuclear power plants. You get to figure out what to do with a 5 million ton or 5,000 ton or whatever it is structure that has now become completely radioactive. You get to figure out what to do with the radioactive waste. Meanwhile, the guys who are running the company right now, they're running off with $1 million salaries. I mean, it's nuts.
Exactly.
It is nuts. It is absolutely nuts. And it's why we need to be investing in the future in wind and solar and other things. Back to you.
Yeah, one of the things about that is I feel it's a very it comes towards education, and we're just not educated to think that solar and wind is good. I just remember in high school, you know, we talked about Rockefeller creating the first refinery and getting a monopoly on that. And it's like he's glorified it. He's making millions off standard oil. And he's like that.
Chris, I'm sorry, your phone has just fallen off the edge of the earth. But you made your point.
Oh,
you
really?
Made it well. Thank you very much for the call. Danny in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Danny, what's up?
The caller that you had on advocating nuclear power.
Yep.
I live 30 miles away from the St. Helens nuclear power plant.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to ask this guy, and I'm like, why didn't you ask this guy? I'd love to say, hey, I'll tell you what, take these spent fuel rods and bury them in your backyard underneath your house.
Right. Do you know who Art Robinson is? Danny?
Sounds familiar.
Art Robinson is the guy who ran against Peter DeFazio. Who is, I don't think he's your congressperson from St. Helens.
No, it would be Ashland.
Right. He's actually the south, you know, down the southern part of Oregon. But Peter DeFazio ran a guy, and they used to, Peter used to have a website up called whoisartrobinson.com. It's probably still out there. The Republican who ran against him claimed to have invented a process. He said, you know, low levels of radiation are good for you, so the solution to our nuclear power problem is to take all the nuclear waste in the country, dilute it very much by mixing it with home insulating material, and insulate people's homes with radioactive waste. Yes, this is the Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives who ran against and nearly beat because a couple of Wall Street financiers poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into this guy's campaign, Peter DeFazio, in the last election. So, you think it's strange. You say, hey, you know, why doesn't he put some of this nuclear waste in his backyard? There's actually people advocating that.
Tell that to all the children with leukemia and people like me with brain cancer.
Oh, my. I'm sorry to hear that, Danny. It's tragic. It's wrong. Danny, thank you for the call, and thank you very much for watching Free Speech TV. Will in Chicago. Hey, Will, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you for doing what you do. Hey, let me tell you a story about, you know, this gentleman who was on with the nuclear, you know, promoting nuclear energy. Right. Let me tell you a story about somebody who was directly affected by Chernobyl. Me. I had the opportunity to live in Berlin, Germany for 3.5 years. And as you know, I found out from you, some of my favorite foods in the whole world are milk products and nuts, cheeses. So I ate a lot of that when I was in Germany. And I ended up being poisoned from cesium-136 from Chernobyl. That was the fallout from that. And I'm now hypothyroidic. I have to take medicine every day for the rest of my life as a direct result of the Chernobyl incident. And, you know, you were the one that pointed it out.
Yeah.
Talked about how you took a Geiger counter into a grocery store.
Yes.
And started, doing Geiger counting on food in the grocery store.
Yes, in Kulmbach, Germany in 1986, in the months after Chernobyl. And, yes, we found that the nuts and the mushrooms in particular went off like crazy, bad pun. And the milk was detectable. And yes.
And those were my favorite foods. I ate a lot of them. And after spending 3.5 years in Germany, my thyroid failed. And doing the test, it was because I have cesium poisoning that caused that to happen. So
Amazing. For
this gentleman, and that was, you know, American traveling abroad, living abroad, just eating foods that I like to eat have been directly affected by
it. Was probably the radioactive iodine, actually, that got your thyroid, but it has a very short half-life. So it's only around for the first, you know, few weeks or few months, but after Chernobyl. But if you were there after, what was it, May of my birthday is May 7th, and I landed right around my birthday. So Chernobyl must have gone up right around May 1st of 1986. And,
but even then, you know, you talk to anybody in the State Department, and they talk about the fact that a lot of Americans that go over to Germany, the Eastern Bloc countries, have problems with their thyroids when they return.
Yep.
And, you know, once again, because of what you were saying, we've been able to piece it together that this is an issue. It actually is a food issue. They still have ongoing contamination problems to this day in those areas of the world. So, you know, for those people who are traveling abroad, just be careful of milks, nuts, mushrooms.
Well, and now we've found, and you can see this on the USGS website, that the radiation from Fukushima has now spread all across the United States. We need to say, and Japan needs to say, and any country, I mean, around the world, we just need to say no nukes, no more nuclear weapons, no more nuclear power plants. It's an inherently unstable and unsafe technology. The nuclear weapons are immoral to the point of extremists, and nuclear power is crazy. You shouldn't have to split an atom to boil water. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do that, including concentrating solar power, as they're doing out in the Southwest, you know, to huge
solar
advantage.
Solar power, geothermal, nuclear, hydroelectric. There are so many other options, and for us to continue to put this corporate welfare to do that is crazy.
No, you're absolutely right. Thanks a lot, Will. Yeah, it's the Price-Anderson Act, by the way, when I say corporate welfare, if you want to check it out. Without the Price-Anderson Act that gives federal loan guarantees and federal insurance guarantees to nuclear power plants, Wall Street won't go near them. Insurance companies won't go near them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And this is supposed to be our hope for the future. While the rest of the world is developing 21st century technologies, we're stuck with 20th and 19th century technologies. It's amazing. You know, you think about nuclear power, and you've got to have cold water to have a nuclear power plant, right? They use massive amounts of water. But we can't have hydropower, right? That would be too green. So you got to have massive amounts of water. You spit it out hotter than you brought it in, so it screws up the environment. You got to mine the uranium someplace. In the United States, it's mostly on Indian land, on Native Americans' land, where they have big problems with the tailings and the contamination. Tailings is the waste, you know, the leftover stuff from digging up the uranium. And then you got to process it. Then you got to transport it. Then you got to, anyway. And worst of all, it's centralized. It's in one place. Now, that's great for the corporation that owns it. They can meter every little ounce of it that goes out, every last water kilowatt. But shouldn't we start having decentralized power in America? Shouldn't each neighborhood generate its own electricity and not have to depend on some giant corporation that's based on Wall Street or in Germany or in France? I mean, it just kind of seems to make sense to me. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, before we get anything like that, we're going to have to defeat the ideology of Iran by the Republican Party.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm totally with you. And it's not even, you know, partly it's the ideology that says that if a corporation does it, it's wonderful. But partly, I mean, you know, it's one of the things that the corporations are doing is they're buying government. This is, and nuclear power is probably the best example of it, because it's an industry that wouldn't exist if the federal government didn't backstop the bank loans that allow it to them to build power plants, and didn't backstop the insurance so that, you know, they're insured against a disaster. If they didn't do that, that, you know, Wall Street has never been willing to fund nuclear power. And
you know, Tom, the Republican Party, it's like a corporation. They're only interested in the bottom line. They're not interested in doing anything for the country or moving this country forward. And it's so crucial in this election, we've got to defeat the Republican Party and defeat this ideology that's going to destroy the country.
Yeah.
It's all hands on deck, Tom. We got to really get out and work, all of us.
I'm with you, Mark. It's not enough to just squawk about it. You got to show up. Tag, you're it. Pat in Orfordville, Wisconsin. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Yeah, you know, I live out in the country here right now. In the last few days, it's been so windy, I wish I could have a small wind tower.
Yeah. Same here.
But, you know, there's not anything that's set up for small homeowners like that.
Yeah.
So I and secondly, you know, I live within the shadow of the Byron nuke plant down in Illinois because I'm right on the state line.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a shutdown just a short time ago. That's close to the Chicago metropolitan area. And nobody reports these things. And, you know, it makes you wonder, okay, what was the shutdown really about?
Right.
And so these things happen all the time. And in Texas, they just had their Senate, their legislature was bought off by, Hal Sparks reported this Saturday, was bought off by the lobbyists, and they're going to put a dump somewhere on one of the aquifers. That's how money in politics works.
Yeah.
But the reason I called was you are always interested in the First Peoples. And I watched a thing on PBS last week that really pointed out the healthcare thing to me, and I thought of you instantaneously. The Wampanoag Indians, some of the first peoples that met the pilgrims and the colonists, they became ill from probably the good things that we, the
It's probably
Canadian,
flu.
We
brought flu over, and it killed a lot of people.
And so they were ill, and the people under Joshua Winslow and some of the people who were in that group of people here said, we will trade land for medical care.
Wow.
So how about going back that far for the importance of medical care to people and how we have been involved with the lack of health care from the time of basically whenever the First Peoples arrived.
The founding of the country. That's incredible. Pat, thank you for sharing that story with us, and thanks for listening to WCPT. I appreciate it. Greg, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Greg, in Roseburg, Oregon. You are in Peter DeFazio's district, speaking of same.
Yes, I am. I keep up with the politics and get emails and stuff from Peter DeFazio. I just recently got one. Art Robinson is challenging him again in this next congressional election.
Right.
And he has his son, Matthew Robinson, has changed his registration from Republican to Democrat so that he can run against Peter DeFazio as a Democratic candidate.
In the primary?
So, in the primary.
So he's trying to blemish DeFazio in the primary, the same way Romney's being weakened by this primary. He's trying to weaken DeFazio so his dad can take him out in the general election.
If his son can't get the Democratic nomination and knock DeFazio out, then it should deplete a lot of DeFazio's money,
right,
and make him weak enough that Art Robinson has a better chance of getting in.
And then everybody in Roseburg gets to have nuclear waste in their insulation in their homes.
Well, that and cutbacks on our schools and
That's
a
right.
lot of the other crazy stuff.
Art Robinson believes that we shouldn't have public education. He homeschooled all his kids. It must be including his son, who is is running against Peter.
Not to mention he has a developed program that he sells for homeschooling. So who wins with that if he cuts school funding and people do homeschool?
Yeah, amazing.
I mean,
it's amazing. Yeah. Greg, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Catherine in Abilene, Texas. Hey, Catherine, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, that guy must be a nuclear zombie for some corporation or something, because I was we were stationed in Germany for 6 years, and during the Chernobyl part,
right.
And I got cancer, my kids got cancer, and I remember when the rain came, they told us, don't go outside.
Yep.
We had to wear plastic stuff all over us,
yep.
And they dug up the sandbox, you know, and guys were walking around with Geiger counters.
Yep, I was there,
but,
you know,
then. We weren't supposed to get anything, right?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that you have cancer. It may not be Chernobyl that's causing it, and it could be. Catherine, thank you very much for the call. I wish.
This is what the Air Force did to me.
Yeah, well, it's. I would say it's what nuclear power did to you. I mean, you chose to join the Air Force, and the Air Force is in.
No, my husband did.
Or your husband chose to join the Air Force, but.
Yeah, and the Air Base kept sending me for tests and didn't tell me what it was, and they in San Antonio, and they kept on, like I had to show up, and they did all this stuff to me. So then I said, you know, I couldn't take it. I went to my private doctor, and he was shocked because they were testing me, and I had cancer, like, for, he didn't know how long I'd been walking around with it.
Wow. Catherine, I'm very sorry to hear your story. Thank you for calling and sharing it with us. As I said, there's no way that you can draw a direct association, but there are tens of thousands of cancer deaths as a consequence of Chernobyl all over the world, actually. Bill in Spokane, Washington, it says that, about nuclear power. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Well, you know, your earlier guest that was such a big proponent of nuclear power and how safe it was and how dangerous solar power was.
Yes.
It's all
he never said that, actually. He just refused to answer my questions.
But it still goes back to the conservatives that always complain about compact fluorescent bulbs. They all know there's mercury in that. But if you say, how about the mercury in coal, they give you a blank stare like, I never heard of such a thing. It's they
right.
only hear what they want to hear.
Yeah.
You know, and as far as direct cause and effect, you know, nobody ever died of falling off a building. It's a sudden stop at the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, nobody ever died of nuclear power, but they died of cancer.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Margie in Des Moines, Iowa. Yeah, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, what's up?
Hey, I am calling to let you know about the coolest new thing in energy production.
Okay, what's that?
Solar highways. The technology exists.
I have read about this.
It was developed in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in its prototype. They're actually doing parking lots with it now.
Mm-hmm.
But once this is once they finish these last stages, they have the technology and the ability to turn our entire highway and road system into a solar collection grid.
And you add that to the technology that Toshiba's been selling now for the better part of a decade, which is roof shingles. That are solar panels, solar collectors. And if we simply re-roofed every house in America, and if we turned all of our roads into solar collectors, you know, what an amazing thing. How much power could we have? It would be virtually unlimited. Margie, thank you so much for the call. Andy in Chicago. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was going to talk to you about education, but now that this energy thing is popping up, I'd like to say a few words.
Got a minute.
My father works for the power company here, ComEd. The main power company from Northeastern Illinois. Illinois is a state that generates a lot of its electricity from nuclear. We have a lot of nuclear power plants. It is so easy to put solar panels on a house, on a building. You need three things. You need wiring to run it. You need the panels itself, and you need an inverter to convert the electricity.
Right, from DC to AC and jack the voltage up. Yeah, I know. It's really simple stuff. It's, you know, I've seen it in work in Germany. It's just, well, I've seen it. I actually have a friend in Vermont who lives in a house that's off the grid. I've stayed in his home. And it was built off the grid back in the 80s back in 1980 when Jimmy Carter's, you know, energy subsidies were still in place before Reagan came in and took them out. And
It would be easy to put it in, and it doesn't cost much. The only thing complicated is who's going to do it, how long it's going to take.
And that means jobs.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, we could put America to work. It could be the new TVA, only it's national. It's let's electrify every house in America by putting solar shingles on their roofs. It's just incredible. Andy, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your calls after this. Plus, we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com. Find out what's going on in the world. Stick around.
But what was I thinking?
Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Quite a lot, as a matter of fact.
I see. I think I see that you are at the White House. Yes, there you are.
In the basement.
Eureka. Okay.
Yes.
So what's up?
Several U.S. news organizations have asked a judge in the Guantanamo War Crimes Tribunals to keep the court open to the media this week if an alleged Al-Qaeda chieftain is allowed to testify about his mistreatment in secret CIA prisons.
Hmm.
Now, what defense lawyers are saying is they say, look, the court is it's pretty sure they're going to meet in a secret session if the judge allows testimony from Abdel Raham al-Nashiri, who's a Saudi, and he's accused of orchestrating the Cole attack, the USS Cole attack.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have 3 days of pretrial motions on Wednesday. Now, he would be the first former CIA captive to give a first-hand account in court about interrogation methods the government considers to be secret. And defense lawyers want his treatment in CIA prisons on the record.
Now, two questions come out of that. A, obviously, you know, what are the probabilities of that? But B, didn't last week a memo come out? Philip Zelig is, or Zelikoff is sticking in my head. Tell me if I have the name wrong. Of a Bush advisor who wrote a memo during the Bush years telling George Bush that if he allowed the kind of behavior that you're describing here to continue, that he himself as a president could be indicted as a war criminal?
I believe so, but I didn't cover it closely.
Okay. So it's unlikely that whatever this testimony is, it's going to lead to Bush being indicted as a war criminal.
Yes.
Do you think that the testimony will come out? Will it be on the record? And is there any even remote possibility that it will be publicly covered? Or is this just, you know, the defense trying to get some PR or make some noise?
Well, it probably won't be publicly covered, but it might be allowed. Journalists normally watch these hearings from behind soundproof glass, and the audio feed's delayed 40 seconds. If judge closes the court, they won't be able to. The law mandates the proceedings must be open to the media and public in certain narrow, limited circumstances.
Hmm. Is that true of all military tribunals?
Yes, these tribunals. So the attorney representing the news organization says a blanket closure would not be in the public interest because matters to be discussed at the hearing, quote, shed considerable light on how the U.S. government treats high-value detainees and how such treatment affects both the fairness and the appearance of fairness of these proceedings. Now, the judge hasn't indicated how he will handle the request. Now, the CIA does acknowledge that Nashiri was subjected to waterboarding, that agents racked a semi-automatic near his head and wrapped up a power drill while he was blindfolded. Defense attorneys say he was stripped naked, chained to a wall, as part of sleep deprivation. And they also say that jailers should stop shackling him to the floor when he meets with them, saying that obtaining his testimony with leg chains reminds him of the trauma he suffered in CIA prisons and impairs his ability to help prepare a defense. So we'll see how far they get with this.
Okay. And, okay, what else is going on?
Well, Syria. Tomorrow is the deadline for this supposed peace plan. I say supposed peace plan because I frankly think it's dead. This is a peace plan that was brokered by Kofi Annan at the end of last month. It's a six-point plan that the Syrians signed on to.
Right. And this was basically a mutual ceasefire between the government of, I want to say, Bashir.
Of Bashir al-Assad,
yeah,
and
Bashir
the
al-Assad
rebels.
And the rebels, yeah. And
then over the weekend, Assad said, you know, actually, we're going to add some things.
Yeah, great.
We're going to add that we want a written guarantee that the rebels will lay down their arms and surrender them before we withdraw from the towns.
Oh, marvelous.
And so the rebels took a look at it and then said today, no.
Yeah, that worked. That works really well when you know, bank robbers take hostages and say to the police, just put down your guns and we'll come out.
Exactly. Then things got more complicated today.
Yeah.
Turkish officials accused the Syrian military of shooting at Syrian refugees inside Turkey.
Oh, my.
They say that Syrian army shooters attacked a group of Syrian civilians who were crossing the border seeking sanctuary. At least 23 were wounded. Two later died. Also, some Turks were hurt as well. And the border violence also affected Lebanon. A Lebanese TV station said Syrian soldiers killed one of its cameramen and wounded a colleague as both were filming from the Lebanese side. Now, this is now turning into an international situation.
So Lebanon and Turkey both share a border with Syria.
Yes.
I don't have a map in front of me, and I'm not that good on geography
Neither
of that region.
Neither am I, but they do.
Okay, interesting. So it's and this is now spilling over into both these countries.
Yes, basically. And so they're both furious.
Yeah.
I mean, Turkey was already furious. Lebanon was sort of going, oh, we don't want anything to do with it. They're furious.
Yeah. Okay.
So the whole thing is absolutely disastrous. Oh, and Syria also said part of our new idea is Qatar and Saudi Arabia have to renounce their support for the rebels.
Now, Russia has pretty much pulled back from their obstructionist, I guess, or
had signed on, along with China, to this UN and Arab League-backed peace plan that everybody had agreed to.
Right.
Until Syria added these new conditions.
So do you think that this is going to be enough to tip everybody over the top and it's going to be Libya all over again, bring in the planes?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I think it's going to move people closer to that.
Yeah, I agree with that, whether it's going to hit that tipping point or not.
That's the question. I don't know if it gets to the tipping point. The violence was very extreme over the last two or three days.
Remarkable. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen Ratner's birthday present to South Sudan. Check it out. Thank you very much, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great seeing you. We will be back with more in our third hour. What are we going to do in this country to bring about a nation that actually works?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Who's screwed in America? The jobless. The Republicans are seeing to it. If you're out of work, deep trouble. As nearly 13 million Americans are looking for a job, federal funding to retrain American workers and prepare them for the jobs of the 21st century, drying up. It's going away. Now, you would think that, you know, funding for job training programs around the country would, you know, at least continue, at least stay where it should be, the funding for job training programs around the country, that the Republicans would be looking at this and going, hey, you know, we've got a bunch of for-profit schools that are offering funding, that are offering job training programs around the country. But actually, you know, 2006, the economy was doing okay, and we were in the middle of a banking bubble. Bush was president, but it's down 18% from there, even though there are more than 6 million more unemployed people now than there were then. Funding for counseling for the unemployed, like resume guidance and job interview coaching, is down 13%. In fact, funding for job retraining for Americans is roughly half of what it was more than a decade ago. So now, even though the economy is slightly improving, businesses are now finding that they can't find workers to work for them. People have been out of work 2, 3, 4 years. They don't know the latest versions of the software. If it's a desk job, they don't know the latest way to operate the machinery. If it's a job that requires operating machine. President Obama's job proposal said, let's increase job retraining programs, right? We're spending less on job retraining right now than we were when, you know, 6 years ago, when unemployment was half of what it is right now. So why don't we spend, you know, $3 billion a year? I mean, that's, it ain't, it's chicken feed, right? It's a couple of, it's a month in Iraq or less. Afghanistan now. Studies show this is a really good investment, by the way. Every dollar spent on retraining unemployed Americans produces $8 for the local community. But multimillionaire Congressman Paul Ryan's Republican trickle-down austerity budget, guess what that does? The one that all the Republicans except 10 voted for in the House of Representatives a week and a half ago, and that Harry Reid might make the Republicans in the Senate vote on. I thought it was really interesting, the headline on Drudge, you know, senators might be forced to vote on budget. Right, yeah, hold their feet to the fire, gunpoint, something like that? No, it's just, hey, let's hold a vote. You guys liked it, you voted for it in the House of Representatives. Let's try it here in the Senate and see how many Republican senators who are up for re-election want to go on record as saying, yes, we're in favor of giving the very rich a $3 trillion tax cut, privatizing Medicare, and doing away with job retraining programs, among other things. What the House Republicans said was it's far more important to give $3 trillion in tax breaks to the super rich than to give job skills to working Americans who have been out of work for more than a year. You know, a lot of Republicans have come on this show to complain or to do what seems like complaining about unemployment being high. You've heard it. Day after day after day, you know, Republicans will come on, conservatives will come on, they call in. Really interesting, by the way, in the first hour, we had that caller who called in, and he had some Republican talking point that he was, you know, kind of repeating over and over again. And Paul said he had three callers within 10 minutes of each other, and they all said the exact same thing when they called in. They're from different parts of the country. This is one of those, you know, make money at home programs. You're a right winger. You want to make $25, call into the Tom Hartman program and get your point out. Well, good luck. Anyhow, these guys come on this show and they say, oh, the unemployment is so high. It's terrible. We got to do something about it. You know, they do the same thing on TV and radio shows and print. But, you know, they're not really complaining. What they're doing is they're bragging about their own accomplishments. How is that? Well, conservatives across the country have laid off almost 500,000 workers since Obama came to office. At the federal level, they forced Obama to lay off more federal employees. But in the states, you know, it's almost 600,000 altogether since Obama came to office. Just last year alone, Republicans passed laws in the House. They were all blocked by the Democrats in the Senate. But had they made it through, it would have laid off another 7 million American workers. So government workers have been dropping like flies, 600,000 so far. While during the Reagan administration, both Bush administrations, millions of government workers were hired, added to the rolls, government was expanded to boost the economy. Despite all this Republican obstructionism, for the past 2 years, over 4 million new jobs have been created in the private sector. Why? Well, you could start with the Obama stimulus program. Jared Bernstein helped write this thing. He's been on this program, talked about it. When Obama came into office, we were losing 700,000 jobs a month. That was the legacy that George Bush left. That was Bushonomics, Greenspanomics, Reaganomics. Libertarian philosophy, deregulate the banks, everything will be wonderful. Right, you deregulated the banks and we went from zero to $900 trillion worth of CDOs out there in an unregulated, invisible market, and it crashed. 700,000 jobs a month lost under Bush to 24 straight months of job creation now under Obama. Now, some of those jobs came, as I said, from the stimulus. Some of them also come from Obama saving General Motors and Chrysler over Mitt Romney's objection. Remember that op-ed that Mitt Romney wrote for, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, it was the New York Times, titled, Let Detroit Go Bankrupt. Right. Jacob, you've got that clip of Mitch McConnell, don't you, where he said, you know, our mission in life is to make sure that President Obama is a one-term president. This clip is the Republican strategy on jobs. Has been for the last 2 years. Mitch McConnell, here it is. The Republican
job. One of your quotes from last year where you said, quote, the single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. So how do you respond to those Democratic lines of attack?
Well, that is true. That's my single most important political goal, along with every active Republican in the country.
Yeah, there you go. The Republicans have been working to destroy jobs for 3 years. Why? Because they're trying to destroy Obama. If they can drive up unemployment or keep it high, they're doing everything they can. Fortunately, you've got enough Democrats in the Senate that they've been able to block this insanity coming out of the House of Representatives, the Paul Ryan budget and all these other things. But in the states, I mean, you've got a bunch of states out there that are run by Republicans, and they've succeeded in destroying over 500,000 jobs, another 100,000 cut at the federal level. So when you hear Republicans call into programs like this, come on as guests, call in, you know, whatever. When you hear them on the Meet the Press, oh, unemployment's so high. Oh, it's a terrible thing. Oh, unemployment. They're not complaining. They're bragging. They're talking about the work that they've been doing. It's the Republicans who brought us all this unemployment. They're bragging. I mean, just consider for a moment destroying people's jobs as a political strategy. I honestly don't believe that there has ever been a time in American history from the George Washington administration through the Lincoln administration, through the Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin. I don't think that there has, the most corrupt presidents in history, Richard, I don't think that there has ever been a time in this country when the strategy of a major political party in order to win an election was to destroy working people's jobs. Until now. I never thought I'd live to see the day. It's just astounding. And as we pointed out in the first hour of this program, then, you know, government contractors, Obama wants to say, you know, if you're getting money from the government and you're lobbying the government to get more money, you have to reveal how much money you're spending lobbying. Republicans are blocking that. Well, how about retraining people for jobs? Republicans are blocking that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This isn't just wrong. It is fundamentally not only un-American, but anti-American. So in our chat room posts a link to wildinthecanyons.blogspot.com/2010/02 Columbia River threatened by yikes. From World War II until the early 1970s, the Columbia River downstream from Hanford had the distinction of being the most radioactive river in the United States. It's from hanfordproject.com. Amazing. Thank you guys. And guys and gals, what, men and women, ladies and gentlemen, in the chat room. Amazing. Let's see here. Reggie in Nolanville, Texas. Hey, Reggie, what's on your mind today? Reggie, you're on the air.
Okay, Tom, how you Reggie. Doing?
Good.
First time really talking to you. I just want to understand, and I listen to you a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I'm understanding a lot of where our democracy is going. I think maybe you agree or maybe you disagree, but I think I need to really, really say this. It's mm-hmm. because a lot of people is not aware that we are not in a situation to where our government has semi-control. It's the corporations that have control, which the corporations at some point, well, at all points, don't really care about us. They only care about the bottom line, which yeah. is the money.
Yeah.
So how are we, our people of the United States, we the people, Congress, we the people, how are we going to be able to fight this? I understand about the 99%. I agree with the 99%.
Right.
But I'm not going to say I'm scared.
Reggie, don't ever underestimate an energized populace, right? It was an energized populace that brought us the original progressive reforms that led to things like the 20th Amendment, the right of women to vote, that ended slavery, that ended the legal apartheid in the United States, at least de jure, right, the legal version of it. It was an activated populace that ended the Vietnam War. I would submit to you that it's public pressure that ended the wars in Iraq and will end the war in Afghanistan soon. It was public pressure that had Lyndon Johnson signing both the civil rights bills and the war on poverty that cut poverty in the United States in half in 4 or 5 years. There are so many very, very positive things. That it was public pressure that brought us the Environmental Protection Agency. It was public pressure that got, you know, cars so that they were safe with, I mean, this sounds like small stuff, collapsible steering wheels and, you know, they don't explode.
I understand that history. I really do. I understand that history. I'm not a young fellow. I understand the history.
So I think it's public pressure that can bring about the changes necessary and break. You know, in 1881, you had corporations, the railroad corporations, the steel corporations, the oil corporations, basically, you know, five railroad families, Gould and I shouldn't even try to remember all five of them. Anyhow, there's these five railroad families. There was the Rockefeller family in the oil business. There's the Carnegie family in steel. You had Morgans in the banking industry. They had cartelized the United States. And so what did Congress do? In 1881, they passed the Sherman Antitrust Act. It took 20 years to break up a lot of these groups, but it started. And it was because of public pressure. If we don't get enough people active, if people don't show up, if they don't participate, and I don't mean show up to vote, that's an important thing, but it's at the bottom of the list of important things. It's like showing up to participate. Showing up to be part of one of the political parties, showing up to be part of the grassroots organizations out there.
Okay, Tom, can I say one thing?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I understand our president is not the person who have the paycheck in his hand. Most folks don't understand that. And I understand that perspective. But if we got a Congress that is not on our president's side or trying to block everything that he's trying to do, how come they are not getting the negative publicity?
Do you know what the approval rating is of Congress right now, Reggie? It's 11%. It's lower than it's ever been in history.
I understand.
I think the American people have this figured out. So what we have to do is translate that into electoral victories. And that's where it's going to be a challenge because there's going to be $1 billion, maybe $2 billion, maybe $3 billion spent in the next election. And an awful lot of it's going to come from Wall Street, from the big oil companies, from the bankers. I was talking in the first hour about how the bankers are creating a pact just to take people down, not to build people up. So it's getting nasty out there. Reggie, you got to move along. Thank you very much for the call. I understand your concern and I share it. I absolutely share it. We have to get out there. We have to get active. We have to show up and participate. Kyle in Schenectady, New York. Hey, Kyle, what's on your mind?
Well, hello there, Tom. What's on my mind, I was going to talk about retraining. I did go through government retraining in 2005 as a 44-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of skills, an MBA and all this stuff, but I wanted to become a IT technician working on servers. And the government did give me a grant, and I used that, and I paid it back.
That's great.
You know?
That's great.
So, and the fact is, if they're dumping those kinds of things, it's exactly people my age who should be really, really worried.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know. Right, you know, and in 2006, I mean, during the Bush prosperity, when everybody thought, hey, everything's wonderful, look at the stock market's hitting record highs, and that was when, at that point in time, job retraining funds were 18% higher than they are right now. And so, you know, this is the consequence of compromises made with Republicans who are trying to destroy the economy, who are trying to throw more and more people out of work so they can blame it on Obama. And if they do, if Romney comes into office, then they'll do the exact same thing they did with Bush and Reagan and Reagan. Grow the government again. And it's like it's time for Republicans or for Democrats to call them out on it. Thanks a lot for the call, Kyle. We need to call out the two Santa Claus theory, call out what Jude Wininski started. You know, he's long gone now, but and call out Reaganomics and just say, no, we are going to build this country into the 21st century using 21st century technology.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Why are we arguing with the Republicans about whether we should repair roads and whether we should build a 19th century oil pipeline? We should be talking about a smart grid. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very pseudepismaticously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. Food for your brain. The good. The Sacramento Area League of Associated Muslims. The group allowed a churchless Christian congregation to use their mosque for Easter services on Sunday. Reverend Michael Moran, leader of the congregation, asked the group for permission to use the mosque. And after never allowing non-Muslims to worship there before, the group allowed for the Easter Sunday services. The head of the Muslim League, Dr. Metwali Amer, said that the gesture, quote, represents the true peaceful essence of the religion of Islam. As Reverend Moran pointed out, the gesture was a step toward peace among the two religions. Hopefully we can take more steps as a nation and stop the hatred and intolerance of Islam in this country. The bad. Representative Vicky Hartzler. Hartzler told a crowd of constituents this weekend that she has doubts over President Obama's birth certificate. That's right, we have another birther on our hands. When asked about the president's birth certificate, Hartzler said, I have doubts that it's really his birth certificate, and I think a lot of Americans do have such doubts. So Hartzler is the latest conservative to jump on the conspiracy theory bandwagon. When we birthers realize that there are more pressing issues to deal with in our nation, like the economy or health care, when will all this nonsense stop? Oh, right. As long as that black man is in the White House, it's going to keep on. Yeah, okay, I get it. And the very, very ugly Steve Doocy. On today's episode of Fox and Friends, Doocy argued that the notion of a war on women in America was invented by Democrats because President Obama's stimulus plan was a failure. He said that since President Obama would have a hard time campaigning on his economic record, the Democrats invented a phony war on women to win over women voters. The only thing invented here is Ducey's logic. The reason our economy isn't in total ruins is because of the president's stimulus plan. The stimulus plan continues to be America's life preserver and keeps us from drowning in Bush-era economic policies. Of course, misinformation is nothing new coming out of GOP TV, and the fact that we have come to expect a steady flow of lies and deceit from a media outlet is very, very ugly. Boy, is that very, very ugly. Elaine in Colorado Springs. Hey, Elaine, what's up?
Well, I just want to tell you that I'm 87 years old now, but when I was a child, in my 6 years old, my dad had been out to Colorado, and he told me that they were heating their homes with the sun in Colorado. When I grew up, I'd be heating my home with solar, well, I don't know if he called it solar energy. He said it with the sun in my lifetime. And, of course, we had a war instead.
Yeah.
But whatever happened in Colorado, they must have had solar panels up at that time. But I think it was written up in one of those progressive science magazines that years ago.
Yeah.
But then when I was sitting at the table eating with a friend here in this retirement home where I'm living, she told me that she lived in Miami and that they had glass solar collectors on the roofs when she was young, and that their electric company came along and told the people that if they went all electric and didn't use their solar collectors, they'd give them a better price for their electricity.
Oh, gee.
And I just wonder who's running the country. I think that Roosevelt wanted to have the federal government run the utilities so that we wouldn't get outrageous hikes for it, and it was outrageous in Michigan. I lived there for 50 years.
Yeah, what you're remembering about, Elaine, is the REA, the Rural Electrification Administration. And what happened was in the cities where, you know, to get electricity from a power plant to a house is only a few hundred feet or a few thousand yards of wire. It's very cheap to electrify a whole bunch of houses, particularly an apartment building or, you know, high-density housing. very inexpensive, and so producing electricity is very profitable. But if you're going to take it 30 miles out into the country, it gets really expensive. So what the REA did, what Roosevelt did, was he said, we're going to electrify all of America, because what we had in the 30s when he came into office was electric power in the cities, and people in the country were still you know, using kerosene lamps. And so the REA electrified the rest of America using federal funds or supporting private companies with federal funds. It depended on where you were in the country. And then, you know, the TVA and others, you know, built some large facilities to generate electricity. And then Eisenhower, I believe, it might have been Harry Truman, but it was around that time in the late 40s, early 50s, did the same thing with the RTA, the Rural Telephony Administration. Again, the phone companies didn't want to take the telephone lines out into the rural areas, and so, you know, the government backstopped them. Elaine, thank you for the call. I have to move along. We've got a bunch of other people here. France and Yucca. How do you say that? Say it again.
Yucaipa,
California. Yucaipa. Okay. France, thanks for listening. So what's up?
Hey, I love your show. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I had solar panels since 2004. I haven't paid a cent for electricity since then.
Wow.
And we have a second house, put solar panels on there. Now I'm making money with my power. And now we have a small company, and we've been donating solar panels to nonprofit organizations. So,
oh, that is great.
Basically, that's the perpetual energy model where we get all the money back for a tax write-off.
Right.
The electric company has to chip in, and the people of the like we use animal shelters, you know, they have free electricity pretty much, you know, for 50 years or something, you know.
Yeah, so that's about the lifespan of a solar panel. Franz, thanks for sharing that story. It's a great one. And I mean, we need more of these. Sam, I don't see a city for you. Where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is me from Point.
Oh, Sam, hey, in West Virginia. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing a little better, I guess.
Good.
I was going to ask you a history question, but I don't know if you want to get into history today.
Well,
you old hippie, you.
Whatever you'd like. You got a minute, Sam. What's on your mind?
Well, I was going to ask you who exactly wrote number one on the Bill of Rights. I read something about Benjamin Franklin. I was just going to ask you that.
No, I don't think Franklin had a lot to do with the Bill of Rights. That was 2 years after the Constitution, and he basically just showed up when the Constitution was being written to make introductory remarks. He was quite elderly at that point. He was in his late 70s, early 80s. So
well, I was going to point out, I read that he attended five or six churches there in the city of Brotherly Love. Is that how they got their nickname, you reckon?
I don't know. I would be very surprised if Ben Franklin ever set foot inside a church.
Yes, he did.
Oh,
he certainly did. Five or six of them. He said he liked the way they harmonized.
Okay.
Maybe
he had a girlfriend there. I don't know. But
he might have had three or four.
But I know Ben Franklin was no fan of religion. But, you know, that doesn't mean that he didn't go to church.
But you just said he wrote the first number one on Bill of Rights.
No, I didn't.
You did?
I said I don't think Ben Franklin was involved with the Bill of Rights, because that was a couple of years after the Constitution was written. And by that time, I think Ben Franklin was in decline. You know, it was Jefferson who said that he would pull the Virginia vote for the Constitution itself if a Bill of Rights wasn't attached. He was in France at the time, though. So, but there, you know, the Bill of Rights was worked out in committee. I mean, it was a committee of Congress. Congress, you know, came about in 1889, and I'd have to look at, I've got my little pocket Constitution here. It was a couple of years later that all the Bill of Rights were ratified.
Well, you know Ben
I should just tell you.
Ben Franklin was really into freedom of speech, too. What? Because he owned a newspaper.
Yeah, but that was
no reason he had the post office.
That was long ago and far away. Okay, the Bill of Rights were ratified December 15th, 1791. So that was 2 years, 3 years after the creation of this country. And at that point, you know, as I said, I think Franklin was pretty much in decline. Sam, thanks a lot for the call. I frankly should know, and I don't, who was primarily responsible for the Bill of Rights. Nick in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just had a point about taxes. I know you've been talking about how the super rich have been brought down to like 25% or even 15%, down from 75% or 90%.
Yeah.
When that took place, it really changed the way the whole stock market worked, because now the CEOs have some incentive to take their profits as bonuses.
That's right.
If they didn't have those bonuses, then they wouldn't, then the corporations have to get rid of their income at the end of the year.
Or they would have to pay, or they could pay their workers decently. I mean, before Reagan dropped that top tax rate, which allowed not just the CEOs, but also the members of the executive board, the senior executives, and the stockholders to take huge, you know, incomes and pay very little taxes on it. Before that happened, everybody, all the rich people basically, had an incentive to keep their money in the system, in the company. So what would the company do? It would do more R&D. It would do more advertising. It would develop new products. And it would pay its workers well. And that's why up until Reagan's tax cuts, the average spread between the average worker's wage and the average CEO's wage was 30 to 1. Now, an average worker in the United States right now makes $25,000 a year. So twice that, four times that's 100,000, 30, 15, 7. So that would be about $700,000 a year for a CEO, if I'm doing math in my head fast enough, more or less, $700,000 or $800,000 a year. And yet what we're seeing now is CEOs making far more than that. In some cases, they're making 1,000 to 1, 10,000 to 1 in some of the Wall Street institutions. But the average in this country is around 500 to 1. And it's all because of tax policy, as you correctly pointed out, or mostly because of tax policy. The other thing, thank you, Nick, for the call. The other thing that allowed that change is that CEOs, it used to be illegal to compensate them with stock options, and now you can. And so once they roll over those stock options and exercise them, convert them into cash, that money, even though it's compensation, is not, they don't pay regular income tax on that. They pay a maximum 15% on that. And so, you know, you get nasty behavior in the boardroom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what do we do about it? Well, let's start out by rolling back the Reagan tax cuts.
From the war against disorder.
One can hope. Welcome back, Fred, in Lexington, Ohio. Hey, Fred, what's up?
Hey, good evening, Thomas. This is the first time I've called.
Thank you.
I just had to call you tonight because while I was waiting for you to pick up, I was trying to formulate my thinking so I could be clear about it. If we look at Bush Gore and the use of the Supreme Court in that endeavor, we all know what happened. Now we've got President Obama's health care in front of these gentlemen. And we're all, you know, in bated breath. But I was thinking of an analogy where I'm going with this. As a white combat veteran of Vietnam, one evening, three or four of us set out Claymore mines because we knew we were outnumbered. We were afraid, and we wanted to get out of this valley that night. Well, during the night, one of my friends went out to make a nature call and looked down at our Claymore mines, and they were all turned against us.
Hmm.
So the Vietnamese came in that night and skunked us.
Hmm.
Well, unfortunately, we got out of that. But the analogy is this. The far right have orchestrated a very brilliant tactic. Think about this for a minute. They've gone into state legislators, governors, the right-wing power seekers in all these states, and they've turned the tide on us, utilizing the Supreme Court. They're circumventing and usurping legislative tactics. This is being done very intelligently, very deliberately, and we're allowing them to get away with it. I don't have an answer as to how to stop it.
Well, in Michigan, apparently what they're doing is just flagrantly illegal. And, you know, one way to stop it, the Democratic Party is suing them, and the courts are enjoining them. And we need to expose what Rick Snyder is doing in Michigan. And the person who's been leading that charge is Rachel Maddow. God bless her. And you know, everybody else is going to be jumping on that bandwagon soon. In Ohio, or in Wisconsin, rather, you know, Scott Walker's facing a recall election. In Ohio, John Kasich saw his signature piece of legislation get, you know, overthrown by the people. We're increasingly, and some of these anti-voter laws are being stopped by the courts. So, again, I see a wave of voter activism and awakening in America. And, you know, in response to that, of course, there's the counter-revolutionary force or the counter-reactionary force of Fox News and their viewers. this kind of small Tea Party fragment, but I don't think that they reach that many people. I mean, it's more than Free Speech TV, but it's and more than MSNBC or anything. But we're talking 3 million people on a good day. There's 300 million people in the United States. I think most people are awake and have some sense of the craziness that's going on.
Well, I think when we
I'm still listening. Oh, I guess you vanished. George in Daytona Beach, Florida. Hey, George, what's up?
Not much there, Tom. I got a simple question. What happened to the gentleman that invented the Bloom Box that was on 60 Minutes?
I don't know what that was.
Basically, it's solar energy that would energize your whole home for the cost of about $3,000 to the box.
Huh. I don't know. I would have to spend some time on the Google machine on that one, George. I'm sorry. I just can't, you know, respond to it because I don't know the details of it. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I've been thinking about a linchpin to bring down the right-wing radicals.
Mm-hmm.
I think I found it.
Okay.
Gas prices are going to continue to go up because the oil companies do not want Obama back in.
Well, and neither do the banksters, and the banksters are driving this as much as the oil companies.
Now, we need you back in the chart business. What I'd like you to show on one of your charts is how the oil comes out of the ground, where it goes to next, and how it winds up in our gas tank.
Right.
Because that's going to show people that it doesn't come out of the ground and go into the United States.
Right.
It goes into the world market.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to one of my brothers, Stan, over the weekend, and he said, you know, I remember when that oil well was spilling down there, the Mercado well down in the Gulf, and he said the president shut down a whole bunch of oil wells down there, basically shut down the oil drilling industry in the Gulf until they got this thing fixed. He said the price of oil didn't change more than the price of gasoline didn't change more than 5 cents.
No, this is a manufactured price to bring the president down.
That's right.
There's a direct correlation between poll numbers and gas prices.
Yeah.
That's something every American uses.
Yeah.
And if you can pull that linchpin and show the corruption there.
Yeah, well, I think
that's going to translate into corruption in other areas.
And I am good point, Corky, and thank you for calling and making it. I am hopeful that more and more people figure this thing out. Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Dwayne, we got a minute to the end of the show today. What's up?
I'm sure. I just wanted to point out that it was the people that demanded that the Bill of Rights be added to the Constitution before they were going to put up with replacing the Articles of Confederation.
Couldn't be, because the Constitution was ratified in 1789 and the Bill of Rights wasn't ratified until 1791, 3 weeks,
but
3 years
it
later.
It was going through the process, and most of the states said that they weren't going to approve it without
their ratification was contingent on the Bill of Rights.
They actually honored it. The people who wrote the Constitution meeting in secret did not include a Bill of Rights. In fact, there was only one right included in the U.S. Constitution. And that was a super right, but that was.
And which right was that?
The right to import slaves. The people who wrote our Constitution.
Where is that in the Constitution?
It's. I'd have to draw up my.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you if you like. I mean, it's there. The right.
I know that the right to import slaves ended in 1808 in the original Constitution.
And
so that you're drawing the implication from that the right to import. I get it.
No. It's clearly there.
Okay.
The major problem was that the people who were interested in slavery didn't want a Bill of Rights, because if you have slaves with rights, it's really difficult
you got
to
a problem.
Keep them in
yeah.
line.
Okay, Dwayne, thank you very much. It makes perfect sense. I know that the people who were, well, we don't have time for the whole long rant. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, will the Defense of Marriage Act be declared unconstitutional? Maggie Gallagher of the National Organization for Marriage is going to drop by. Plus, space, the final frontier for billionaires. Rand Simberg is going to be here from Competitive Enterprise. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
To Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.